Hello, Bashers, and welcome back to another episode of Shop Talk Show. Joining me today is Jared Bailey, the Dungeon Master for his own podcast, Maximum Pew Pew. Whether you're shooting lasers or magic missiles, you got some pew pew. Now, for those of you who might be listening to this on another feed, my name is Jason. I am the player of Tam Westcrown from the Shield Bash podcast. And Jared, why don't you tell us a little bit about Maximum Pew Pew so our listeners know what to look for there?
Yeah, sure. So, again, my name is Jared. I'm the producer and, I guess, principal game master for Maximum Pew Pew, an actual play role-playing game podcast that primarily focuses on the Starfinder role-playing game, as well as other titles such as Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood, Free League's Alien RPG, and a few other goodies as well. We've been running the podcast since about beginning of 2018, actually. It was right after the release of Starfinder, so we started with the Dead Sons Adventure Path, so we've been at it for a while, currently on hiatus right now because of, you know, the unfortunate circumstances that a pandemic creates when you're running stuff at the table. But that's kind of the story of Maximum Pew Pew. I'd like to thank you all for having me here. It's great to kind of get back in the seat and talk shop with like-minded people.
Oh, I would not have it any other way. I don't know if you are familiar with the name of Jason Lillis, but...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, I presume so, but like he was the inciting, unknown to him, he was the inciting person behind this whole series, because I really wanted to talk to him, and then I was like, you know what? Let's turn this into more, and let's just keep talking to people. And it was through his Twitter account of What Do You Do Pods that I started finding all of these other podcasts and set up all these other conversations. And today's conversation, listeners, is going to be about kit bashing. This is one picked by Jared here. So Jared, why don't you tell us what kit bashing is?
All right. Kit bashing, probably the best way to describe it, kit bashing originates from the model making sort of subculture. So artists or modelers would take parts from various commercial model kits like model cars, model trains, and they'd literally bash them together to make an altogether custom, personalized, and unique product.
Like in a cartoon where you just take two engines, smash them together, and you get a whole different engine?
Right. So, yeah. You know, let's take a, like you've got a Ford Mustang model and a Chevrolet Camaro model, and you just want to take the best parts out of both and make some sort of amalgamation. Because you can, you know, like everyone's already putting that model together, you know, per the instructions and painting it or whatever, but it gives you an opportunity to make something, you know, unique for you. And the same practice can be translated into role-playing games. Now, I've been kind of a lawful good person my entire life. Like I've always been like, you know, do things to the letter. And one of the most important lessons that I learned as a GM is that the rule book is not the law, and that I'm not beholden to it. You know, I'm not married to this 560-page document that I purchased. Like, I can bend it to my will, not vice versa. So, a lot of people can kind of call this, like, home ruling as well, but it goes beyond, like, home rules. This is, you know, literally taking systems from like other games or creating brand new systems and just sort of plugging them into the game you're doing right now. So there's some examples that you had kind of come up with earlier. Was like we discussed in Twitter, like advantage and disadvantage is a very good example. So if you're familiar with 5th Ed, there is the concept of advantage and disadvantage where you roll 2d20 and you take either the best of the results or the worst of the results, depending on whether you're rolling at advantage or disadvantage. If you're familiar with witches from First Ed, you know, it was fortune and misfortune. You know, the hexes that a witch could put on someone, like, once a day or whatever. Yeah, so Starfinder, like, which is kind of like our shtick, I don't think there's any official use of advantage-disadvantage. But something I did as part of our game was we created like a shared dice pool that allowed people to roll, stuff at advantage or disadvantage, or be able to re-roll d20s to try to get a better result. So even there wasn't anything like official in Starfinder, we try to implement it as well. And like I said before, like, we started playing Starfinder almost immediately after that hardcover came out at like Gen Con 2017. It was a big book, but there was like a dozen races in it. Yeah. Like, there was like the seven new races that it introduced, and there's like five legacy races that were like your half elves and your halflings, your half orcs. And that was it. So yeah. When we were starting to play, like, if you wanted anything other than like these dozen races, you pretty much had to steal from other books. Like, you had to make it yourself, or, you know, we stole from Pathfinder First Ed, because, you know, there was a ton of races in there. And, you know, two of my favorite races were like the Tengu and the Tieflings. Neither of them were represented yet. So, you know, I created NPCs that were in our game that I had to basically just sort of take rules from First Ed and try to fit them around what looked balanced with Starfinder and do that. Now, you know, 3 years after release, I checked Archives of Nethys. There's 560 races.
Yeah, they did not stay low. Like their race to class balance is way, way off.
Oh, well, and they, one of the ideas with Starfinder is they wanted it to have that, quote, cantina feel. That, like, you go in there and there's just, like, a bunch of different species in there. And they've certainly done that now. Yeah. But, I mean, you jumped from 12 to 560.
Yeah, that was one of the things I had when I started playing society games for Starfinder, was it seemed like every other game they gave me a race boon. And yeah. It was just like, I'm not going to have 12 characters in the first season. Like, what do right. I do with this?
And, you know, it sort of offsets how stingy they were in society play in First Ed, where, like, you had to, where they introduced, like Tengu and Weiyang and, oh gosh, I forget the other one that was in there. And then you had, like, Tiefling and Asimar that were in there. Kitsune, that was the other one. And you had, Tiefling and Asimar that were in there a while, and then you had to, like, jump over hoops to try to get, like, Rat Folk, and then a few years later, it's like, oh, now everyone can play Rat Folk, so the people that busted their butt to try to get a Rat Folk, like, they're at Gen Con that specific year, you know, they get all heated because, you know, they did all the, put all this work in to try to get this character, only for, like, everyone to have access to it. Like, it...
Yeah, I traded off an Oriid boon to get a Kitsune boon, and I was like, sweet, I got the Kitsune boon. I gave it to my wife.
A few years later,
it wasn't even that. It was like 2 months later. They were like, it was like, Kitsune is now just a playable race. I was like, oh, great, thanks, cool.
And then, like, all the you still had to get boons for the elemental ones.
Yeah,
and then you could, like, you could combine all four. You could Ultron all four into there's another boon. Yeah, the Sully. Like, you could just
connect the story of the four people, one playing an Ifrit, one playing a an Undine, one playing an Oriid, one playing a Sylph, and they and then their fifth person buddy, and one playing a human, and then the sixth person, their buddy, who was the Sully, and they called themselves the Planeteers and Captain Planet.
Oh my god.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
You can't have anything nice, can we?
Are you kidding me? You better not be making fun of Captain Planet, because you know what? He's a hero.
He is a hero. Something, something, pollution, zero, loot and plunder. I don't know.
I don't know. It's that's been the like live 20 action years. Movie. I'm since... waiting for them to start making the live action Captain Planet. But anyway, we're things off we topic as we often
oh,
are.
Oh, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Just brace yourself.
Yeah, so yeah, I noticed that with Starfinder, they, you know, they had their new class, which were wonderful. Like, they had their roles, but they weren't just reskins of first edition classes, which was nice. And then, you know, they had their races, but then, you know, they just started flooding it through. So you had to, you know, but before then, it was kind of limited. I do the same kind of thing. I learned to play TTRPGs with third edition Eberron.
Okay.
And I love Eberron. It's probably the nostalgia factor, which happens, you know, back to the Captain Planet thing, but I love those races, and they always felt like the Eberron races were more powerful anyway, so I just let them into Pathfinder games. And a lot of people play them, and it doesn't actually take a lot of adjustment on our part, but you end up with just these Everon guys running around Galarian.
Yeah, the races in Starfinder seem okay to me, because literally the way the point buy system works, you can make any race work, like in whatever class. Like, it wasn't like an Ifrit would make like a terrible cleric because of the wisdom penalty. Like, if you want to have like a Ifrit mystic, that's fine. Just put your points in there, and you're not like falling behind. Like, you're not struggling. You can meet that need, and that's what I liked about it. So really, you know, we've got these 560 different like races that you can pick from, and it's really just kind of like the flavor of them. Like the attributes, the mechanical parts, they're fine, but you know, this one can glide, and this one gets a free feat, and this one has dark vision, and you know, you just kind of pick what you want there. Or this one can breathe underwater, but you know, we're all wearing environmental suits, so it's very situational stuff. I feel like it works, and I feel like that's part of the reason why they can get away with sort of flooding the market with that. And that's kind of the reason why I didn't mind making my own Tengu and Tiefling back in 2018, because, you know, I didn't really feel like I had to worry about balance. They were NPCs to begin with, so, like, the monster building rules for Starfinder are a bit different. But, yeah, like, back in 2018, when we had one hardcover and one or two AP volumes, like, there wasn't much content. Now I'm looking over here at my bookshelf, and I've got 8 different Starfinder hardcovers, and I've probably got close to 30 AP volumes, right? Like, there's just, like, way more content now. So, kitbashing and homebrewing several years ago was a necessity. But, you know, we'll kind of talk a little bit more about that, because it goes beyond Starfinder would have been doing. But, yeah, that's kind of the basics is, you know, we're taking stuff from other places, and we're jamming them in there. We'll see what works.
What are some of the major advantages you found? Obviously, like, expanding your player options is a big one. You know, everybody wants to be able to play the character that they've got in their brain, and sometimes you have to find a way to make that work in the system. But what are some of the other advantages you have found to kitbashing?
So, I was able to break this down to 3 different things. So, one major advantage of kitbashing is it's a way to integrate new rules or systems into a game. Second, it's a way to improve upon or supplement existing rules. And third, it's a way to completely replace rules that you don't like. So we'll talk about the first one. So we can integrate new rules or systems into a game. So near the end of our run of Dead Sons, one of the characters who literally their shtick was they wanted to hack the planet. Like, that was kind of like, you know, they maxed out computers. That was their thing. Their arch nemesis, they had a hacker battle. It was a showdown that pitted, you know, the PC who was trying to keep this whole massive ship security from coming down on them versus, you know, their arch nemesis who's trying to spur that on. So they're kind of like in cyberspace, like trying to reroute this everything. So there's not really anything in Starfinder for that. It's much more a cyberpunk or Shadowrun type thing where you have like these slicer battles. And I really didn't want it to come down to a series of computers checks, because that's kind of lame. Boring. Yeah. So
yeah, the big dramatic moment where it's like, you know, you got all this flavor text and then it comes down to roll computers.
Right.
Yeah.
So I made up a game. Like, I made up a game. It was a combination of Yahtzee and some Uno cards. So here's the gist without getting too much into it. They played Yahtzee, right? But it was competitive Yahtzee. So there's like the same type of things that you have to get for Yahtzee. Like, there's only so many full houses, so many large straights, all that stuff. So they're competing for these things. But the Uno cards allowed them to change the result of one of their dice. So, like, you would roll something, and if you had, like, the one Uno card, you could change one of those dice to a 1.
Nice.
Or so, like, it just allowed you different things to, like, augment. So it was like Yahti on steroids, but it was also competitive. So we're, like, competing for these different nodes. And once we, like, capped something out, it just did, like, a bunch of damage to the other person. All the while, the rest of the party's fighting off what security forces are already in the room. So now you have, like, three people doing what four should be, while the fourth is over here needing to be protected, doing sick hacker battles in cyberspace. You know, I didn't have to worry about balance there, because I figured both of them skill-wise are probably similar. Which means, you know, if your PC's got, like, a computer of plus 25 and your NPC is similar, I don't want this to be settled by just a straight dice roll. So, you know, it became a game. It became something a bit more competitive. Another thing I did was I wanted the characters to be heroes. Like, I'm very pro-player. Like, I want my players to succeed. So I gave them ultimate moves. I gave them ults. And, you know, that's cool. They could... So once a session or once a day or, you know, whatever their ult was, or they'd spend resolve or something like that, they could use an ultimate. So, like, I've got my... The character that was, like, our head pilot, I gave him a ult called Space Supremacy, and it gave him bonus dice when he was on his ship. Or they were on their ship, sorry.
Yeah.
So when they're on their ship, they get to roll bonus dice. Plus, they could spend a resolve and treat their pilot skill. They could treat their ranks in pilot as being, like, 50% higher, which meant they could do the crazy stunts earlier. They still didn't change difficulty. They're still hard to do, but yeah, they had opened up to them as well. And that's because, like, they wanted to specialize in being a pilot. So I gave them cool pilot stuff.
And then it's balanced by the fact that resolve is such an important resource.
Right. So they were a technomancer. So that was their class. And they wanted to be a pilot, so they invested a lot in pilot. Yeah, they had to spend a resource to do that. And it wasn't affecting the difficulty as much as it was, like, giving you access to harder stuff that they figured that you would need a certain number of ranks to even be able to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the other people were more combat-oriented, so I gave them combat stuff. So I didn't mind to give half the players non-combat stuff and the other half combat stuff, because it kind of balanced out what these players wanted to do with their characters.
Now, the question comes, how much of that did you plan out with the character, and how much of it was, like, you handing him a card and said, hey, this is your cool new ability?
Little column A, little column B. Because when we started the game, I kind of had a player questionnaire. Like, tell me about your character. Tell me about some dark secret that they have that they don't want people to find out about. I think I used, like, Jerry Hawkins from Penny Arcade, like, his recommendations. So, like, tell me a dark secret. Tell me something they'd be willing to kill over. Like, just a few things like that, so I could kind of get, like, dark secrets and, you know, guidance and stuff like that. And, again, back when we only had one book, there were only so many options. And I think the players didn't really know what direction they wanted their characters to go. Because, you know, every... 4 or 5 sessions, because we were only able to meet, like, once a month because of everybody's schedule. Every 4 or 5 sessions, there was a new hardcover.
Yeah.
So then, like, the character would change directions based off the player getting new information, because you literally doubled the number of character options you had over the course of a month. So some of that stuff had to change. I had, I'll give you a good example. One of our characters, Cena, was a, halfling operative that kind of wanted to go the sniper route. So the first power I gave Cena was something that allowed them to go on Overwatch, which basically, like, you know, you spend your standard and then you go on Overwatch and you can, like, take attacks of opportunity with a bonus or whatever like that. They never used it because what happened was there were so few sniper rifles in core rulebook that they never really had a sniper rifle on them, and they couldn't use
their... They're so expensive.
And they couldn't use their operative attack with the sniper rifle, so they started doing stuff up close. They started using their ghost specialization and doing stuff up close. So eventually, I changed their ult to be something that took advantage of this massive stealth that they had, and said, if you can, like, there's the operative trick where, like, if you roll stealth and get 20 plus the DC of the enemy, then, like, you can do your operative attack and you do massive damage. I told them if you spend a resolve and beat it by 30, you can full attack them and get operative damage.
That's cool.
So, very high difficulty, spend a resource, get three attacks on somebody and do massive damage if you're able to pull it off, because you still have to hit after that.
Yeah.
Like, you hit the skill, whatever, you still have to hit them, and you only get, like, a plus two bonus for it. So, that's one example. The other example that I had to change was our soldier had done, like, a Phrenic Adept, so I thought that they were going to have some, like, mental powers that they're going to kind of augment with, like, their gunplay. And then the direction they went was, like, I want to have heavy weapons all the time. So eventually their skill I plucked from Borderlands and gave him Gunzerker and said, okay, you can dual wield heavy weapons now. Like, if you spend a resolve, you can dual wield heavy weapons equal for a number of rounds equal to your con modifier. So now it's like, you know, they've got two heavy weapons and just, you know, full attack, like 3-6 attacks or whatever. So, but again, that was, as more options were presented to the players, official options, the direction of their character changed. So the other two characters, I never changed their ult because it got so much mileage, like, early on, and their character didn't really change direction as a result. So yeah, that definitely changed, but some of it was me just sort of creating it from the beginning based off of what they told me their character was going to be like, and then seeing it in practice work or not work, adjustments were made.
Yeah. How often do you, in your personal experience, how often do you have to adjust the rules that you're kit bashing in?
It's amazing how many things I do are kind of like one-time use. Like, I feel like I put, like, way too much prep and stuff, but one thing I did was I did do custom weapons, because this game is so much about weapons. And again, when Core Rulebook came out, there was a lot of gaps with weapons. It presented a lot of weapons, but there were a lot of gaps. And it took like a full year until we got Armory. And Armory gave us like 670 new weapons.
Yeah.
Like, I put them into a spreadsheet like one afternoon. I was like, I'm going to put these spreadsheet. I think the official number was 666, but about 670, right? Yeah. So, you know, it was a lot, but there were still gaps, because that number of weapons, instead of like satisfying me and saying that's all we need, in my mind, I'm a little bit more analytical. I like numbers. It told me, oh, so here's all the rules I need to be able to create my own weapon. I just have to backwards engineer it. So I started making my own weapons and started making like weapon lines and everything like that, because there were certain weapons that my characters liked. So I started, you know, I had a one of my NPCs, his name was Sweet Feather, he was a Tengu who had a who had his own ship kind of floating around Absalom Station called the Discerning Dagger. It was a it was an armory. It was his own, like, you know, weapon shop. So they would visit there and get these custom weapons that I put little customizations on and everything. It was a new NPC, somewhere, someone personal they could speak with to get their guns, right? Just, you know, interaction for them to have. But, you know, a lot of this stuff I felt like was balanced enough to where, like, I've sort of got a Word document somewhere that's like, any home game I do, this is fair game. Here's weapons that you can also pick from, because I've created them. They look like they work. The one-off stuff, if it doesn't work, I'll cut it. I'll adjust it, whatever. But everything seems to have worked pretty well. But yeah, that's one thing about kit bashing. Like, don't get stuck in the lost, what is it called? Sunk cost fallacy, where I've invested so much time in this, by God, I'm going to use it. Like, you know, like, if it doesn't work, get rid of it. You know, cut your losses, learn from it, and, you know, just go with it. But
I tried real hard to introduce skill challenges into my home games, the fourth edition skill challenge concept, and my groups just didn't like it. You know, and I tried adjusting it once. and they just never got into it. I think it was the nebulous nature of like being able to create the challenge around you as you rolled. And I eventually just stopped using them because I thought they were great, a great way to, you know, handle a situation outside, you know, and let people have some storytelling power. But I had to abandon it because nobody else liked it.
Some of it's group too, because you've got to have the right group for it. We had an online group for a while, and we were just kind of alternating running different adventure paths for Pathfinder. And one of us was running a Jade Regent that has like the caravan rules, and I was running a Hell's Rebels, which has like the rebellion rules.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you would have like one person out of a group of five or six actually be invested in those rules, and it kind of made it frustrating to try to run it. So like you want to use these rules because they seem neat as a GM when you like read it, and like, okay, it's going to affect the story in these ways. But like, if you don't have that investment, then it's kind of difficult to kind of go along with that. So you do have to have the right crew.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like those little sub-mechanics, because I didn't get to experience the caravan rules. Our GM for Jade Regent just said, this seems like garbage, and just pitched them. But I've played Hell's Rebels. I really liked that. Kingmaker. You know,
Kingmaker's the big one. Like, yeah. That's...
Which, I'm GMing Kingmaker, and, you know, we were real big into the kingdom, but then it was just like, I don't know if it was just my group did such a good job, or everybody ends up with this situation where they just reached a point where they couldn't fail a single check, and, like, their economy was in the 300s in book 3, and it was just like, okay, we're done. Like, your kingdom's awesome, and you should be proud, and it's cool, and we're not going to keep track of it anymore, because there's just no point. You guys are... You just tell me what you want your kingdom to be, because this rule set is, again, you know, it's not working, so we'll just kind of, you know, let you guys story tell it. But it's a thing that, you know, I've personally tried a couple different ways. You know, I mentioned the skills challenges. One of the other ones I used to do was this thing called the escalation dice, okay. Which is a big D6 you put in front of the GM screen. And not every fight gets it, but your big fights get it, and it starts off at 0, so you don't put it out the first round, and then every round you tick it up by 1, and the players add that to their attack and damage.
Okay.
And so do significant enemies. The fights go a lot more dangerous as you roll through, because...
Yeah, the longer it goes, the more... Yeah, the bigger the threat. Yeah, okay.
That one went pretty well, but then... I found, again, it was, you know, basically my players were always mopping everything up by round 6. You know, it was just like, well, you're tearing through everything, if the fight even makes it to round 6. And then I've tried introducing 3 Dragon Ante. That just takes way too long.
Yeah, certainly.
It's a great game, but...
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely a balance for trying not to dominate... Because, like, I'm sure that I could have probably come up with, like, a way more complicated hacking minigame. But Yahtzee, like, playing a hand of Yahtzee, because that's all it was. Like, you do your 3 rolls, I do my 3 rolls. Yeah. Combat round. You do your 3 rolls, I do my... Like, that's kind of what we did. I mean, you're making a decision, you're rolling dice, and in some ways it was going quicker than the average like, because they're... 11th, 12th level at that point, right? You have so many combat options, like, you don't even know what to do with yourself unless you're a soldier, which is just point click. But,
that was the thing I kind of discovered, was the best ones that I've had experience with are the ones that are just kind of, like what you said earlier, kind of taking a rule that doesn't work very well or that you don't like and adjusting it. It's something that just goes into the flow of the game rather than adding another chunk. Just to kind of streamline something, with the exception of obviously your hacker game was a little different, but that was just mostly...
Well, that was
not going to be every time you guys do a hacking thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, because this was like this was book 6 content.
Yeah.
Like, this was one of our PCs wrapping up a personal story arc. This was like career finale type thing.
Yeah, not the sort of thing where it's every time you go to hack a computer, you're going to play this minigame.
Right, because that's a computer's check. He was actively being opposed by his nemesis, basically. One example, I wrote some notes here. One example for kit bashing completely replacing rules, Starfinder spaceship combat is really divisive. And I don't know how many tables of Starfinder you've played where you've had to deal with spaceship combat.
What?
One. Okay. A lot of people don't like it. I was very fortunate. The table of Maximum Pew Pew, it was me and four players. Three of those four players are Starfinder Society GMs.
No, that's nice.
So they know the rules. They're intimately familiar. And the other guy that was at the table was pretty familiar with the rules. But you know, wasn't like comfortable with GMing. He also was like the least local of all these as well. Like he was commuting to play. But the other three, they're GMs. They're intimately familiar with the Starship rules. Probably in some cases better than I was. So everyone knew the rules. They had read the rules. They hadn't just come in and like, I want to shoot a ship and roll dice. But it was something we talked about because Starship rules were so thick in this game, and a PC game that a lot of us had played at the time, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Elite Dangerous. So Elite Dangerous is a sort of spaceship simulator. It's on Steam. Recently, well, in the past 2-3 years, a tabletop RPG version of it came out. You know, nice, thick book, well-written, based off of a flight simulating game, okay, where combat is a big deal. Like, customizing your ship's a big deal. Combat's a big deal. Combat in this big, thick book, 3 pages. They've simplified it to the point where you can have, like, this mechanically complex, like, game mechanic complex ship with all these different parts, the different accelerators, the different thrusters, the different hulls, the different armor package, all this stuff. Combat, 2-3 pages. And they've simplified it to that point, made it so easy to be able to do combat and handle initiative and handle who's engaged and everything like that. And it seemed like a very good way, a very good substitute for Starship combat in Starfinder if people didn't like that combat. Also, Starship combat in Starfinder is sort of like the Millennium Falcon scale, where your crew is about 5-6 people.
Yeah.
Versus or like a Firefly type scale, where you've got like 6 people are kind of like your crew. Versus like Starship Enterprise, where you have like hundreds or thousands of people, and all the way down to, you know, Luke Skywalker, Red 5, one person in an X-Wing. And that's kind of what Elite Dangerous is. It's like one person has their ship. That's their baby. So that type of Starship combat might appeal to different people. Like, I want my own spaceship, and that way we can make it a bit more tactical with, you know, small scale that way. So
yeah, especially in Starfinder, you basically can't do anything when you're piloting by yourself.
Yeah, because there's rules for, you know, small ships like that, where like one or maybe two people, but like trying to pilot a ship and gun at the same time with one is kind of miserable. And to also do like sensors and all that stuff, like, I get it, I understand it, but it's not everyone's cup of tea. And yeah, like, if you're the person that's like, I'm not good at combat, but also I don't have one of the three relevant skills for Starship combat, so I guess I'm just going to try rolling diplomacy every time and root everyone else on. Like, it can get boring.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and I know they expanded that in one of the operations manuals, but
yeah, there's
it was a Starship specific one, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's a Starship operations manual. I'm looking at it right over there.
And but even then, I think they basically just expanded like some of the roles, so it's like, oh, you don't have one of those skills? Well, do you have one of these skills?
Yeah, but they already took like a 30-40 page section on Starship combat and gave it its own hardcover.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got a different game that, like, on PC, all you do is fly around, and they condensed it down into something simple that works.
Yeah. Which so sounds like an easy substitute of being like, okay, ignore this, read these 3-4 pages.
Yeah. So that's a case of replacing something entirely. I don't like these rules. I'm going to replace it entirely. You know, you had the GM that did that for Jade Region. Maybe they replaced it with something else. Like, even if it was a simple role mechanic, like, I don't like this, let's do something else. Kingmaker, you could, all of these different games, you could, like, take something else. The mass combat rules that were introduced circa 2005, I forget which book, was it Ultimate Campaign that introduced the mass combat rules?
Yeah, okay. Ultimate Campaign / Book 5 of Kingmaker.
Interesting idea, but some people didn't like it. And there are games that already do that. So, you know, if you want to do your big combat scenario like that, like, okay, we're going to pull out this book instead.
Yeah.
And we're going to play this game.
Yeah, specifically for that, I've got the Strongholds and Followers by Matt Colville that I'm going to use those mass combat rules because I just find them to be a little bit smoother.
Look at you kit bashing already. You didn't even know it.
Well, I will admit, listeners, when I got suggested kit bashing for the topic of this conversation, I was like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And then 10 minutes later, I was like, okay, so I thought I knew what this was, but I don't think I do. So
you've been doing it and didn't realize it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know. It's like when I was a kid and then somebody was like, hey, you're pretty awesome. You're acting like an awesome dude. And I was like, I've always been this way. I just didn't know how to name.
Yep.
Anyway, so we've gone over a lot of the advantages of it. And not to sound like the negative Nancy, but what are some of the disadvantages of it? Like, does it ever lead to power gaming or introduce a rule that you are like, this doesn't really work, but the players were like, no, we love this. Don't take it away.
Yeah, so I was able to boil this down to three different questions. Is it a good idea? Is it balanced? And is it overly complicated? When I'm in, like when I'm focused on a game, like I'm running it, I've got a good group. That's all I think about in the evenings. That's what I go to bed thinking about. When I'm at work, sort of, you know, like during a lull, like I'm sort of brainstorming. I'm always trying to churn ideas. I've always got something on the back burner. You know, I'll throw it down into like a Google Doc and maybe come back to it later, or maybe that's all I need to do is like write a few sentences and like, okay, that's out of my system, go on to the next. So yeah, sometimes I'll have wild ideas about game mechanics and I'll try to figure out how to implement them into a game, but the problem is that usually the same people that I would normally vet these ideas with or use as a sounding board are also in the game. So
I get that, yeah.
It's kind of difficult to vet some of these ideas without ruining the surprise. And sometimes things that I think are fun might not be for others.
Yeah, that's the thing. And, you know, I personally don't like it when somebody comes to me with a rules change in the middle of a game as a surprise. Like, to me, that'd just be like, no, like, talk to me about it ahead of time. Great.
Yeah.
But, you know, springing that stuff on me. I would not appreciate that, I know.
Yeah. One thing I did do, and I at the beginning of the AP, I made each of my players like a three-ring binder folder. And I put a copy of like the player folio. So I had a PDF copy. I made a copy of the PDF folio for them. So if they wanted to use like the big PDF folio, that was available to them. It had pockets because every now and then, if I had new rules or came up with something new, I'd make a print off and like, here you go. So they had like documentation of it. Like it looked like we're going to like a uni class or something. Like it was crazy.
They do that for my kindergartner. That's the sort of thing that they do for that.
Yeah, but like, I wanted it to be helpful to them. That way they could keep their character sheet and everything nice and together and everything. But I knew that I was probably going to be giving out like a lot of paper and stuff. Yeah. A lot of the prep I did, like when items dropped, like I actually made item cards. Like here's the grenades, here's the ammo, here's all this stuff. And I'd paperclip them and I'd put them in the area in the book where like this would drop. So they'd kill an enemy. Here's your loot. Like, you know, like slide it across the table. I would read it for the audience, but instead of having someone have to sit there and like two flash grenades, two, you know, like here's your stuff. And then like when they use that item, just like rip it in half, whatever.
That's cool. No, that's a good idea. It's probably took a lot of work of like copy, paste, cut it all out and all that other stuff, but I'm sure it made the game itself go a lot smoother.
It does, like, that is an instance of investing a lot of GM prep into something that's going to save a lot of time at the table. Because this is a group of people that I'm not able to get to the table for, like, you know, a month at a time. I want to be respectful of their time, and I want to get through content. You know, we want to get through content. We don't want to spend 20, 30 minutes doing bookkeeping or, you know, like a cumulative 30 minutes just writing down like all this, these guns and stuff. So like I'd slide them across. Once we got to the upper level stuff, like I started putting like levels, page numbers, everything like that. So like it was just, you know, easy for you to get access to that at the table. I didn't want to waste their time. You know, I didn't want to waste listeners' time because that's not very good listening for a podcast listener, like having to hear all this, like, yeah, so this gun is on, you know, armory page 32 and it's 11, like, is readily available.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also stops, you know, because I know some podcasts will just hold all of that off until it's off mic. But then, you know, you get this cool item and it's like, well, if we're going to wait till the end of the episode to look all this up, I may want to use this item now.
Yeah.
It could be cool.
And that stuff that I would read off, but like at the same time, like the players already had like that access to that.
Yeah.
And actually the players would, like when they leveled up, instead of doing it at home, they would just like hang out at the house for an extra 30 minutes or so and level their character there or just discuss options. And that became bonus footage. So because if people were really interested in the mechanics of the characters and stuff, they could just hear them talk about, like, you know, like looking through the books and stuff. So like I just throw that up as bonus footage.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Other disadvantages, is it balanced? This is the first time some of these ideas are seeing light of day. So you don't know if they're balanced until, you know, this session. And sometimes it's like live on podcast when it happens.
Yeah.
But
I imagine you also have to have a good group who's willing to like try out a rule and then if it doesn't work, scrap it or change it.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
And that was the nice thing about like our group with Dead Sons is that we had three other GMs. Several of them have experience with game development. Like they understand the why. Right, like they understand why this is the case. You have to lean on your experience as a GM and your rules mastery to make a good guess. Like you have a rules mastery with Pathfinder First Ed, so you could make a really good guess as to what like a 4,000 gold piece magic item might look like.
Yeah,
you know,
or
like
what a fair DC for a skill check is, or. You know, right. What poison to do or stuff like that.
Yeah, you've got a fair idea. Like, and you could make something unique. You could have a fair idea of what that looks like. But once it comes into contact with players, especially the clever ones, like it becomes obvious where the broken bits are. You can go back to the drawing board, work with the player to balance it a bit better. But, you know, it's going to take some time. Last, is it overly complicated? So overly complicated mechanics might not be for everybody. We talked about Kingmaker. We talked about Hell's Rebels. We talked about Jade Regent. You know, we talked about Starship Combat. There were some ideas that I thought might be interesting. Like, I actually, like, custom-made D20s. I don't have one in reach right now. Well, let me... One second. So I custom-made... like these D20s here, right?
Cool.
Like I painted them and everything and had these big plans as to what I could do with them and gave each of my players one at session one and never touched them after.
Okay. Real quick here, for the listeners, we just got shown a D20 where the sides were painted a variety of primary colors.
Yeah, and there's also some designs and stuff there, so... And I gave a printout with, like, you know, what the colors and the designs looked like and all that stuff and never used it because I had this idea of, like, oh, so, like, maybe they could roll that with certain weapons and it would be, like, different critical effects or whatever. And I never implemented it. And then Armory came out with all the weapon mods and stuff and kind of did sort of what I was thinking about anyway. So it was like, well, that... you know,
just that, didn't fly.
So, you know, it was something, and that's one idea that I scrapped. Like, I figured, okay, this is probably overly complicated. We don't need something that does this. Just, you know, what? Just scrap it. You would asked about power gaming. You know, I, like I said, I'm pro player. If you wanted to call some power gaming, let it. Yeah, I'm in the player's corner. Some of the earlier weapons that I made for Dead Sons were a bit broken, but the nice thing about, like, Starfinder is that every level, these weapons start to get a little bit dated. So eventually they're going to be replacing weapons pretty soon. Some of the weapons they held on to for a while. You know, if you want your players to be powerful, like, you know, let it rock. That's, like, yeah. You know, and if it's too much, like, that's why I wasn't too worried about weapons, is I knew that, like, eventually there's going to be, like, a new set available to them that they're probably going to want that's got better damage or does this or does that or anything like that. So I knew that they were going to be dated quickly.
Yeah, that's fair. A little bit more difficult than some of the other versions, some of the other games, I imagine. But then again, there's also some games that, you know, weapons are much more nebulous and it'd be a lot easier on. But it's definitely one of the things, it sounds like, with kit bashing, you have to make sure that your players understand that these are essentially play tests. You know, you're introducing something new.
Yeah.
And if it just really doesn't work, they have to be willing to give it up.
Yeah, and I'm always going to be pro player. If I mess up, like, I'm going to admit it, and I'm going to backtrack, or I'm going to rule in the player's favor or anything. If I realize that, you know, the I gave the boss, like, way too many hit points or anything, or if I miscalculated or something like that, I'll make good on it. Like, that's the other thing, too, is, you know, you don't want to infringe upon the goodwill of the players that are sitting there letting you experiment upon them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, when you're introducing things on just your side of the screen, you want to make sure that, yeah, it's not going to unbalance the game in your way, too.
Right. One of the questions you asked was what controls I try to put on things. Again, now, I've been...
Listeners, just to let you guys know, I send an outline here to Jared. That's where he's saying some of this stuff, even though you haven't heard me say these things. I sent a basic outline earlier.
I know you had mentioned power gaming. I forgot about the control part there. So I've been GMing for, like, almost close to a decade. Most of my experiences with Paizo products. So I've got that comfort level. Like, I know what Paizo's trying to do when they do particular stuff. I understand the importance of, you know, the different types of bonuses, what a +2 feels like in combat, what a +2 feels like with a skill check. Why certain skills cap out, like, why, you know, BAB does, like, you know, spells and all, like, all this stuff I feel like I understand. So you've really got to lean on that as, like, your controls is, like, you know, I have a good feeling, like, if you're not super familiar with the rules, you know, maybe be a bit more conservative with what you do. But you know one of my sessions, like, they had helped, like, a crime syndicate, and I gave them just, like, a boatload of drugs. I made up, like, 6-8 different types of drugs for them to use with some pretty gnarly penalties. Some of them used the drugs, though, because, like, there were some pretty cool effects. But, like, yep, here, you all know the addiction rules. Here's the DCs and everything. I'm going to tell you way ahead of time how bad this stuff is. What you put yourself
into. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's going to be no surprise. Here's the benefit. Here's the penalty. Here's the DC. Like, it's, you know what this stuff does. Like, there was stuff that was giving them insane bonuses, but had, like, DC 25 or something, like, fort saves to not get addicted. Like, just really, like, gnarly penalties. But, you know, sometimes you want to be able to take two standard actions in a round. Like, you know.
So, listeners, you will once again notice the theme here of the importance of communicating things with your players, between the players and the GM.
Yeah,
this will keep coming up. Trust me.
Yeah, and I know, like, there might be some surprise, like, oh yes, this drug will let you go faster. You know, and, like, yeah, you get a standard action, I'll make a fort save. Like, you know, there's a place for surprises like that, but, you know, in some cases, like, I just really wanted them to know, like, this was this is what you're in for. Like, if you want to use it, fine, it's here. I'm giving it to you for free. And do with it what you want.
You said, I don't remember if all of this came before the call or when we were talking then or after, during the initial introductions and everything, but you'd mentioned you're at least tangentially familiar with a lot of other non-Paizo systems. So have you found any system? I mean, obviously Paizo systems are very rules heavy. They're very mechanical systems, you know, whereas like you've got things like Fate or even like Powered by the Apocalypse, which are much more rules light systems, especially like Fate Accelerated is, you know, it's like five pages or whatever. Are there any systems that you find are better or worse for kit bashing?
So I thought about this for a while, and it took me a while to figure out what worked well, what worked different. And I think that the rules heavy games are easier to kit bash because there's way more fiddly bits.
Yeah.
So things like Words of Power, Non-Vancian Magic, Firearms, Psionics, Martial Arts, Styles, Food Mechanics. Like, these are things that people years and years ago kit bashed, and then developer thought, that's a good idea, let's put it in our game. Like, Psionics have always been, like, you know, every game's like, let's put Psionics in it. Yeah, or every game's like, why are there no guns? Or, you know, or I like Words of Power. Like, this is stuff that people have sort of home ruled and developed or have existed in previous versions that they want to integrate into their own game. And again, if you've got a rules heavy game already where there are these fiddly bits, things that people want to change or augment or anything like that, that's easy to do.
Yeah, it's almost, you know, since there's so many more rules, there's examples of how something different should work.
Yeah, and let's talk about Powered by the Apocalypse games, because there's I've never played Apocalypse World, but I've played several other Powered by the Apocalypse games. One of the fun ones is Worldwide Wrestling. It's the second edition's coming out soon. It had a very successful Kickstarter. Blades in the Dark is technically Powered by the Apocalypse, but they've kitbashed it so much that now that they're, it has its own, like, sort of Blades in the Dark, like Powered by Blades in the Dark type thing. Like, it's not even, it's they kitbashed Powered by the Apocalypse so much it's no longer Powered by the Apocalypse, because Powered by the Apocalypse was so rules light to begin with. Any changes that you make, it doesn't take too many before you've just created your own game.
Yeah.
There's another good one. There's so many like one page games, brochure games, zine games that are like 20 pages or less. You're dangerously close to just creating a new game if you kitbash it too much. There's a very good example. There's a fun little game called Tunnel Goons, and all the rules fit in like one page. And it's a very simple system. You've got like three different stats, and you have like a weapon and a shield and all this stuff, and you just roll against a DC. But the whole game's like a page, right? So if you kitbash a one page game, and you've doubled the rules, essentially, you've made a new game.
Yeah.
Now you're a game designer. You're not a kit basher. You're a game designer. At that point, you should just make your own one-page game, because you came up with a mechanic that, you know, equals the complexity of this entire game, essentially. So, yeah, it's still kit bashing, but you just became a game designer at that point.
Yeah, which, you know, is kind of ironic considering we're both real big into Paizo stuff, and Paizo was basically a kit bashing of third edition that became its own game. So I don't know if that's actually ironic or not. Maybe Alanis Morissette ironic, but so basically, you know, the more rules there are, the easier it is to substitute or add. And you know, even with Paizo itself, is first edition is a great example of this, because you started off with your stereotypical fantasy, and then you ended up with, you know, more things, a little bit more, and then they're like, okay, well, here's, like you said, Words of Power, Hero Points, Gunslingers, Technology. I think it was season 6 or 7 of Society that was like, hey, here's all the technology stuff.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was 6, because that's where Trial by Machine, I think it was 601, Trial by Machine. I ran that at a Gen Con 2014, like 4 times.
Mm.
And every time I ran it, it was worse and worse for the players. The less experienced the players were, the better they did.
Oh, that's
the last time I ran it was at a table of GMs, and like it was VCs, VLs. I was outranked like enormously. It was people that knew this game better than I did. They about wiped like halfway through, much less the final fight of that game, right? Because they were just because they were having a good old time role playing and stuff, and one of them like accidentally opened an airlock and like almost suffocated the whole party. And then there was this fight with the variant scarecrow that was just like wiping people because no one had anything it could beat hardness. Like it was great, but yeah. And then, you know, we got our, what was the book that introduced like the six, psionic classes, like your psychic and your, the kineticist, the cult guide. Yeah.
Which I'm going to point out they're psychic classes, not psionics.
Right. They are.
Yeah.
And then you had Ultimate Intrigue that brought on like the Vigilante, and like they have branched. I mean, there's what, like 10 plus years of hardcover games.
Yeah, Ultimate Magic with Spell Blights and Words of Power, and every adventure, well, not every, but a lot of the adventure paths have their own sub mechanic within it.
Oh, it's... yeah, like the last like 8 pages or so of just like additional stuff. Like it's.
Yeah, there's a lot to add in, and, you know, it's a great resource if you want to do your own stuff, is to look to see where they've started branching out and doing other things. You know, I remember, I think it's Ultimate Combat has all their stuff for, like, you know, okay, yeah, here's your Eastern weapons, because people love, you know, Japanese stuff, but then here's stone, bone, bronze, you know, like other
materials,
ages of technology that you could, you know, go into, all in there. And even with Gunslinger, you know, you had everything from a single shot blunderbuss to, you know, revolvers from the Old West.
Right.
The more that's there, the easier it is to kind of erase a bit and write in something else without anybody noticing.
Yeah, like I'll use Starfinder. Let's just take the core rulebook of Starfinder. If we replace the spaceship combat, like replaced it completely with something like, say, Elite Dangerous, that game's still Starfinder.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much content, like, you'd have to replace a whole lot more for it to stop looking like Starfinder. You take a game like Tunnel Goons, you take a game like Apocalypse World, or, I mean, Fate Accelerated and Cypher System, those are kind of unfair because they're sort of blank slates anyway. Like, Fate Accelerated's like, you can run this, but feel free to steal from Fate Core, and you're still fine. Yeah, the more fiddly bits, the easier to kitbash, because everything else is just going to be game development at that point.
So, what are your closing thoughts on kitbashing? What is left to be said in your mind?
Kitbashing is wonderful. I'm going to leave you with my controversial hot take, okay? Ooh. There's no such... Yeah, here we go.
Children, close your ears.
Yeah. There's no such thing as a perfect RPG.
I'm waiting for the controversial part.
Yeah, right, see? Like, that's as controversial as I'll get. You know, someone saying that something's their favorite RPG is super subjective, and there's a whole wide world of RPGs to pluck from. From the big companies we all know and love, to the $5 indie darlings on DriveThruRPG and Itch.io, like, that just... Everyone's got good ideas. Like, take the ones you like, put them together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the favorite games I ever played was Dread Light, which is played with a Jenga set.
Yeah.
It's super, super quick and easy, and it's a lot of fun.
And there are a lot of games now that have kitbashed that Dread theory, or like the Jenga board, into like their RPG. So, there was an RPG, I forget the developer, but the RPG was called The Wretched. Now, imagine a scenario in which, like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Alien franchise, but imagine that you are alone on a ship with some type of xenomorph skittering on the outside, and your ship is adrift, and you either have to repair it well enough to be able to start to send yourself towards civilized space, or repair the emergency beacon. And the mechanic is that you draw cards from a deck, and you sort of narrate these particular situations that happen to you. Sometimes you roll dice. Sometimes you draw from the Jenga tower. If that Jenga tower falls, the whole integrity of your ship has gone to zero and you die.
Really, listeners, what you should be getting out of this is, looking, if you want a kit bash and you're not sure what to do, look in your game closet.
Yeah, like, I mean, the hacking subgame, like I said, that was Yahtzee, which everyone's got 5d6, and some Uno cards. We Jenga boards are a good option. Yeah, if you don't like something in your RPG of choice, change it. And like you're saying, you don't have to recreate the wheel in some cases. Because some of these, like, $5 itch releases or $5 drive-through RPG releases, there is a... I'm not sure when this episode is going to go up for you, but Kickstarter currently has a zine quest going on right now, and I've spent an embarrassing amount of money on it because it's people that have just created these, like, short zine-style games. Like, there's a Good Words of Power one. There's a Mothership Funnel Adventure that's coming out here shortly. There's one wild game that is basically... ice skaters creating sigils of power on the ice. There's like it's the Wild West out there, dude. Like,
yeah.
There's but some of this stuff, like, you know, I'm not into ice skating, but I like motorcycles. You know, that's kind of the same. Like, you could integrate these things into other games. Like, you could, you know, take these ideas, change them a little bit, integrate them to the game of your choice. Like
dirt bikes out on the Arctic Circle.
Exactly. Or like just out in the mud or whatever. Like, you know, like guys with their Harleys trying to fight off like these big, you know, gargantuan creatures that you accidentally summoned because you played your guitar too hard. You know, like just whatever. You know, like some Metalocalypse stuff going on here. But
so, listeners, this, we're currently recording February 6th, 2021, so I'm also not quite sure when this is going to come out. So if you go to hear this and go to jump on Kickstarter and it's not there anymore, that's why.
Yep. Probably this stuff might eventually end up on itch.io. I mean, this is I think the big thing a lot of these people are trying to do is use Kickstarters for like a physical release. I imagine you'll be able to get these PDFs once they become available, but there's really good ideas. Like the Words of Power one, for example, I'm not sure if there's a game that's going to be attached to that as much as it's a supplement for like a different magic system for whatever your existing game is. It's sort of like system agnostic, or you could probably turn it system agnostic if you wanted to. You know, 5th Ed's probably the most popular RPG out there. I'm in a 5th Ed group right now. But it's... people are, like, trying to bend it to its will all the time. Like, if 5th Ed were perfect, then people wouldn't be trying to, you know, push Cthulhu in there, push guns into it, push martial arts into it, push all these things into it, right? So... like, branch out. Like, there's some cool stuff out there, and there is something, like, that player at the table that isn't into combat, I guarantee there's an RPG out there that they would absolutely love. So, like, branch out, you know, take stuff from other game systems. You are not married to that rule book. You know, they're not going to come and arrest you if you don't run it, you know, as written. You can take your two favorite games and make them kiss if you want to. It's fine.
Yeah, I always make the joke, like, if you change the rules, the Paizo police are not going to come knocking on your door.
Right, this isn't society play. Now, if you're playing society, yeah, there's rules you got to follow. No,
yeah, that's a whole separate bag of cats, as it were.
Yeah, but we're not talking about society play here. This is at your table making whatever adventures you want. But yeah, that's...
and one of the best ways I find to do it is like just to try some of the other game systems. I know I do this vicariously through another podcast called Critical Hit, and I've listened to them play 4th edition, 5th edition, Pathfinder. They're playing Starfinder, two different Cthulhu games, Fate, two different Powered by the Apocalypse games. Like they've got a wide plethora of choices for you to, you know, go through and listen to if you don't have the time to play these.
Go on YouTube, go on Twitch. When things calm down and it's safe to, you know, go to conventions, try to find yourself a good local con. Like, we've got Charcon here. What con are you repping right here?
Farmageddon in Farmer City, Illinois.
All right, Farmageddon.
Yep, it's right in central Illinois, right off the interstate. Come check us out.
We've got Charcon locally here in Charleston, West Virginia. It's located at the Clay Center right in the heart of Charleston. It's a beautiful venue for it. Can't wait to get back to it once things settle down. But it's a good way to go meet like-minded people and do demos of these games. I've run demos at, you know, these places. I've run demos of Fate. I've run demos of Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood, the Dragon Age RPG. I would have probably ran some like Aegon this past year if, you know, things had worked out a little bit differently. But it's an opportunity for you to try out these things if you're the type of person that prefers to do them hands-on. If you haven't played any of the big games like 5th Ed, Pathfinder, Starfinder, the organized play campaigns that all of these games have are great opportunities to kind of jump in, because they don't require you to have like a dedicated group. So there's plenty of stuff out there. Like, you know, branch out.
One of the things I discussed with Jason Lillis last time was the concept, you know, if you go to a convention and you talk to these people, we're all passionate enough that we're spending extra money to go and play this game. We would love to teach you how to enjoy this hobby that we love.
Yeah. Yeah, I go to Charcon and pay, you know, admission cost to go volunteer and run stuff. Like, yeah. You know, because I want to share this game with people. I like this game so much that I want to share it with you. I'm big into Tales from the Loop and Things from the Flood. Very different rule set. Very much more collaborative storytelling than some of the other RPGs. And I've learned lessons from it. Like, I've learned things that you can do with Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood. I've learned from things that, like, Blades in the Dark or Powered by the Apocalypse do to help improve my GM skills for Tales from the Loop, Things from the Flood, even Pathfinder, Starfinder. Like, you learn from them. You, as a GM, it is a very good exercise to check out some of these different systems, because, again, I was exclusively Pathfinder for probably 4 or 5 years, and just branching out to like my next, which was like Fate Core, Fate Accelerated, I learned a lot about game design stuff from that. So, like, you, if you want to develop your skills as a GM, this is a great way to do it. And then by extension, you're going to start developing your kit bashing skills, because you are by extension becoming a better GM by doing these things. So, you know, get out there and learn. There's so many cheap games available. Like, you don't have to break the bank. I know core rule books for, you know, Wizards of the Coast and Paizo products can be like $40, $50, $60. You don't have to break the bank to check out a new game. Like, yeah. There's budget friendly stuff. If you check out Itch.io, there's some games that are giving out like community copies for free. Like, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to break the bank.
Yeah, I've gotten stuff from DriveThruRPG and River Horse Games. Those are where I get a lot of my PDF games.
Okay.
So, but, all right, well, we are a little bit over our usual runtime, which is usually a good thing. It means we've had a good conversation. Do you have any other questions for me? Any other little bits that you want to cover?
Nothing I can think of right now. I just want to, you know, again, share my appreciation for having me on the show. Glad to, again, talk shop, and glad to be able to share what knowledge, however limited it may be, of kit bashing and my experiences with it.
Well, I hope our listeners enjoyed it. I know I certainly took some good points away from it. And other than that, thank you for coming and being here with me, and we will see you next time, Bashers.
Shield Bash is made in association with Knights of the Octagon and Farmageddon Gaming Convention. Find us online at shieldbash.net, on Facebook at Shield Bash, on Twitter at Bash Shield, and on YouTube at Shield Bash. Music by Lee Rosevier. Serpent Skull and Pathfinder are the property of Paizo Publishing Incorporated. Leave a comment on iTunes for a chance to hear us read it out on the podcast. Questions and comments can be sent to shieldbashpodcast@gmail.com.